due to unforeseen circumstances, this radio show is currently off air.
This is currently off air. In this transmission, I've got a mixtape of sounds from artists with links to Brighton, and music, poetry, streamed bathtub theatre, and immersive gameplay, readings from a new novel, nonsense and reflections on a strange year from Yale Caravan, Tim Harbridge, Silvio Mercuriali, Bright Black, Dave Stevens, Sentimental Punk, Shalice de Toro, and Mum, Dad and the Kids. Welcome along.
It's kind of weird, really. I woke up a little while ago. I actually woke up in my chair. I dozed off, I think, in front of the TV or something. Anyway, I was still in my chair, but I kind of sit in the same chair all the time, so I kind of feel like I know it really well. But when I woke up, there was something on the arm. It felt like something was stuck on the arm. And that's what started me scratching on it, because I wasn't sure what exactly it was. And then I realised it was a kind of little lump underneath the fabric. And it was kind of about the size of a marble, you know, one of those old-fashioned large marbles or ball bearings. It was that kind of size. And I've been trying to kind of get rid of it by rubbing on it as much as possible.
That appears to be a tape from Dave Stevens, who's clearly dealing with a rogue molecule. Here's Yale Caravan.
So here we are, exactly in between an end and a potential new beginning. I'm sitting here on the edge of a roof, at the end, the top end of a building, watching a dark blue sky at the end of the day, towards the horizon at the end. There is water and sky, sitting at the end. Am I looking into infinity? Here we are on the border between an end and a beginning. The end of the day, the end of the year, the end of a pandemic, the end of being part of a bigger family called Europe. I look at the distance and I see the sun is rising beyond the night. A day is born. Endings are frightening. They're like closed doors or walls, and you have no idea what's on the other side, but it could be a wonderful, exciting, new, unknown, frightening, deep, wide, new beginning. I'm sitting at the edge of the island, looking into the waters, into the other side, which once used to be a part of me, a continuation. Should we put an end? A full stop? A comma? A hyphen? I'm sitting at the edge, at the edge of this year. What a year. Was that the end of normality? And then what new will appear, will emerge, will reveal itself? An end in itself is a new beginning. A new beginning knows it will have an end. And so the cycle goes, like a dance, a Sufi dance, around itself. I'm sitting at the edge of my heart, and I can't wait for a new beginning where I can hug you in my arms so strongly and deeply and clearly. At that moment, there will be no more end between what is me and what is you. Only maybe a potentiality for a new beginning. Happy New Year.
Friend of the show, Yael Caravan, sent me something she put together earlier. Just some thoughts about the end of 2020 not being a great year for so many people. Although maybe hedge funders did very, very well this year. They usually do. Yeah, but this idea of the end of this year and the beginning of something new. And I was trying to think what I had that would convey the same sort of feeling or emotion about new beginnings. COVID aside, I mean, it's been a big year for me personally, emotionally. And I was feeling really low at the beginning of the year. And I wanted to write a song that would be somehow uplifting for me. That would be something to aspire to emotionally somehow. And so I wrote a song called "Coming Back to Life" because I was feeling really, really low. No matter how crap everything seems. We can come back to life.
Coming back to life. Coming back to life. Learning to breathe again. To see, just be again. Learning to walk again. To walk tall again. Learning to love again. To love, be loved again. Coming back to life. Starting to start again. Take heart, take part again. I've been out of my senses. My defense is open wide. And though I lament this, I think that I can see some light. I will no longer freak out. I will no longer bawl myself out. Smashing wine glass on my head. See red and bleed out. Coming back to life. Coming back to life. Learning to live again. To give and be a friend. I've been on compass mentis by consensus out my mind. And though I lament this, I think that I can see some light. I will no longer freak out. I will no longer blow myself out. Break a window with my fist. My one wish to beat out. I will no longer freak out. I will no longer blow myself out. Break a wine glass on my head. See red and beat out.
That was Tim Harbridge and Coming Back to Life. Let's check in again with Dave Stevens.
Oh, you're not going to believe it, but my scratching seems to be counterproductive. I seem to have, instead of making it go small, I seem to have made it get a lot bigger. It's about the size of a tennis ball now, and every time I rub it, it just seems to get larger and larger. It's a kind of weird thing. I don't know whether I've pushed all the stuffing from one bit of the chair along to another or something, and that's gone hard. But even as I'm doing it now, it seems to be getting bigger than a tennis ball. I don't actually know what's going on. It's getting really very irritating.
Silvio Mercuriale's latest Alto Teatro show, Swimming Home, is returning in December and January. Swimming Home is an immersive theatre experience for an audience of one that takes place in people's private bathrooms, developed through interviews with swimmers from all over the UK and delivered directly into people's home through a phone app, Mercurius Net. Standing in their bathroom, wearing a swimming costume, goggles and some headphones, the audience is led through a journey of rediscovery of their relationship with water as they prepare to enter their bath or shower. Here's an excerpt from Swimming Home.
I think I've packed all the things I need to go for my swim. Towel and goggles. Some water in case I get thirsty. And a snack. Just a little snack bar.
Now when I go swimming, I set up a training and I follow it.
I get to the side and sit down. I put on my goggles and my earplugs with my legs in the water.
Usually I decide a number lap, and then it may happen that I reach that number and I'm not done.
My first length is always underwater.
I'm just stretching and like lunging through the water.
Mostly I go to relax, to balance myself and to meditate as well.
I'm actually thinking I don't swim that much.
My weight goes away in every sense, so I can feel free. So I continue swimming.
Well, don't you see? I just figured it out. If I take a sort of a dog leg to the southwest, I can swim home.
Why would you want to swim home?
I don't get it.
Pool by pool, they form a river all the way to our house. This is the day Ned Merrill swims across the county.
Hello, welcome to Swimming Home. In your bathroom, the shallow end of a pool. I'm here in your taps. Come close. Listen, do what I tell you to do. Don't worry, it's easy. Just follow my lead. Here, let's start with the first instruction. Turn the sink tap on. Turn it on.
That's better. Thanks for letting me into your bathroom. I am running through the plumbing system around your city, through miles of pipes hiding under the tarmac, around corners, up and down floors, inside your walls, and now I am here, but also elsewhere. You're all standing in front of your sink, with water running at the same time. You can turn the tap off now. Now, stand in front of the mirror with a towel hanging around your neck. Shake your arms a little and rotate your shoulders in both directions. Stretch your neck to release any tension. Wrap your towel around your shoulders. Good. Take a deep breath in and out. Let's begin. Close your eyes. How long has it been since you last swam? Can you remember the first pool you've ever been to? See it in your mind's eyes, the entrance, the corridors, the tiles.
So we would have driven, it would have been a drive to the pool with my parents, and then pulling up in the car park and walking across, and there were steps up.
Run up the steps. Then we walk into this kind of big centre, basically, and the pool, there's the sort of silver kind of barriers. I think that maybe there's a token, and we put the token in.
And then you turn left and left again through some double doors.
The changing rooms around the pool, which is beautifully tiled. The showers on my left-hand side and the swimming pool on the right-hand side. You're entering the swimming pool area and you have to shower. I feel very anxious because I want to get rid of my clothes.
Don't worry.
I'm in my swimsuit.
I'm not going to rush you back in.
I need to get a shower, be clean.
That's why we're here, in your bathroom. You don't need to speak to anyone. You didn't come all the way here to socialize. You are free from who you are. You just want to swim, as if unseen. First, you must shed your layers, adjust your temperature, let go of the edge. Straighten your back. Stand holding on to the edge of your sink. Remember, no running, no diving, no food, no ball games. This is municipal water. The lifeguards have been trained and are waiting for you by the pool outside. Open your eyes.
That was an excerpt from Swimming Home by Silvia Mercuriali. You can enjoy the full Swimming Home experience from the 15th of December. It takes place every Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday or Saturday at 10:30 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. And you can access the show through the app Mercurius-Net or by visiting Sylvia's website, silviamercuriali.com. There's a link to both on the track listing for this show, which you can find as normal at currentlyoffair.com. And now, some random readings from Shalista Toro's newly translated novel, Feral River.
Marquez took the box and fingered its rivets while the boat owner walked to the door. Marquez grasped the revolver. He swung it from side to side to judge its weight. Its wooden grip gave it a pleasant feel. He replaced it in its box, which he locked. With curiosity, he saw the boat owner talking to Cordel. The lad was listening in silence, and finally his boss ruffled his hair. The carpenters were finishing hanging the sails from the mast. The boat owner climbed ashore and joined the waiting people. The lad began to get ready for the voyage, moving ropes and crates and tidying up on deck as the carpenter's last hammer blows sounded out. Marquez could hear a tense silence all around him. He paced over the deck, pursing his lips.
He walked on in no particular direction. Sometimes he still felt the knife on his throat, goading him, troubling him, asking questions. He wanted to spend the night on terra firma, not have to sleep on the boat again. After all that travel, he needed a pillow on land, somewhere that didn't move, where he could dream his dreams. He longed to feel beneath him a firm, secure bed over something more dependable than water. He was searching for an arrival.
This was happening to someone else. It wasn't him. It was someone else. He followed the leader. All he could see were trees that seemed to reach the sky, letting little light through. The heat was clammy, and breathing was difficult and heavy, making him feel suffocated. His feet sank into the sodden soil. The three of them seemed to be going in circles, marking out a pattern in the jungle, perhaps a damp spiral in the earth. It was as if he was sinking into the bottomless well of sickness.
The venture opening up before Marquez had an air of haste and improvisation, but they both agreed that he'd only be able to discover something about the boatman's death if he set sail as soon as possible. He went to sit on the gunwale, gazing at the immensity of the water and hearing the murmurs behind him. He felt anticipation pulling him on, leading him, taking him by the hand, showing him the way, a watery way. Yesterday, he'd resigned himself to the idea of having to travel to another part of the frontier in search of opportunities, and today, his luck had changed. He felt looks drilling into the back of his neck. He sensed river eyes staring at him. The stranger was going to bring the story back.
The friar had the soft, deliberate way of speaking, of one who lives between various languages, and must take care that his words are understood correctly. He seemed to chew his words like a cow chewing grass before releasing them in short bursts. His face muscles drooped, and they continued quivering after he'd finished speaking. "I'm Marquez. I've come," the friar interrupted him. "I know. Cordell has told me. Such a misfortune." Marquez looked at the path leading up to the Indian village. An old woman, followed by a dog, was carrying a bundle of firewood, and further on a column of smoke was rising to the sky. Marquez could sense rather than see people in their daily activities. Having finished shaving, the friar stood up and put his razor away in his cowl. Hands on hips, he looked at the children at the side of the river. Then he looked at the recent arrival. "What is known about the tragedy?" "The boatman returned to the estuary crucified. Someone had burnt him on the mast. On the way back, I hope to be able to tell you more. For the moment, there are only questions." Marquez walked down the gangplank and approached the friar. His shirt, he noticed, was soaked in sweat. He felt a little dizzy, as if about to faint, but it soon passed. "Do you come to judge, to govern, or to execute?" "I come to tell." "To tell? I'm a writer." The friar arched his eyebrows and then perused the writer's boots. "A writer?" Marquez put his hand on a tree trunk to sit down and continued talking to the friar. He felt weary, and sometimes his breathing seemed blocked, but he was trying to keep calm and not allow it any importance. He blamed it on having slept in the sun longer than he should. "An ending doesn't make a story. I'm going to investigate the rest." The friar crossed his arms and regarded Marquez with consternation. Then he lowered his gaze and murmured words that the writer didn't understand. Sometimes the friar seemed to be holding two conversations at the same time, one with himself, one with Marquez. "The rest? You want to know the rest?"
Feral River is a book that I wrote approximately 15 years ago. I was already living in Brighton. It was written in Galician. And I think that probably the fact of being a stranger, a foreigner, writing in Galician in the UK is part of the story of the book. The book is a journey. And I think at that time, what I had in my mind, it was trying to explore the idea of following a route, a map, a genre, the idea that you know what is going to happen somehow. This is a book about a journey going up the river and the obstacles that the characters are going to find on their way. In a way, the fact that the writer and the reader know that there is a map, I think that was the challenge that I was taking. Of course, what happened is that when you are trying to follow a route or a map, things happen, unexpected things happen, and often you diverge from the path and find other things. And I think that's the main interest that I found when I wrote the book, the unexpected, I didn't know that I was going to find this. Of course, the fact that I wanted to write a genre, it doesn't mean that ended being exactly a genre. I think it is, but also shows my difficulties to follow a clear path. And I think I did this genre or this book in my own way, in a way altering the idea of a genre, of a book that explores an adventure going up the river. When I started to write the book, I think I had an ace up my sleeve, a wild card. Probably 15 years later, I still think so. I think it's a great opening. And I thought, well, with this opening, I think I'm going to convince people to read this book, to go up the river with me. The opening is a writer that is traveling through the frontier looking for a job, something to write. And when he arrives to a town in the mouth of the river, he sees a boat coming down with a body crucified and burning, tied to the mast of the boat. And the director of the magazine tells him, "Are you still looking for a job?" That's the main opening gambit of this game. Do you dare to go and find who killed the boatman? And that's the engine that moves this book. Who killed the boatman? And I think the writer discovers something else on his search. Still, who killed the boatman remains a mystery. Outside the book, or I don't know if it's part of the book, there is something that is very precious to me too. That is the translator. The translator is a very close friend. He used to be my boss when I worked at the University of Oxford. He used to be my boss, but I feel him more like a friend, somebody that really appreciates my work. John Rutherford, he's a very prestigious translator into English. He translated Don Quixote for Penguin and got numerous awards for his translation. The fact that he translates my books, is so, it just fills me with pride. I'm very happy for that. I'm also very happy that the cover is made by Jim Sanders, an artist based in Brighton. He's not only a very close friend, but also we have worked together for a long time doing many projects. So he also makes the whole book more precious to me. In looking at him, looking at this book from 15 years ago, it really feels that even if my head and my work now is in a completely different turning, I look at this book with saying, well, that's a book. It's a book that can be read.
The run, when all this happened, was at a different time of year, just before the rainy season. When the rains come, the waters rise over the banks, the river seeps into the jungle, and it isn't easy for anyone who doesn't know the river to trace its channels. Fallen trees drift down and sandbanks come and go. The currents shift them and they get treacherous. Going on the river in that season, if you don't know it, is madness, and many are the stories of boats and men that never came back. The river takes lives to feed its eternity and bring more lives into the world. Manoeuvres are tricky when the water's rough. It shouldn't have been a hard run, but that year the rains came early. I knew it wasn't going to be normal when we hit a sandbank and the boat heeled over. Much shoving and rivercraft was needed to shift her. Then cargo steered to the middle of the river, and we went on. You people moan about the heat we've been suffering these past days. You should be thankful, I'm telling you. Mosquito bites are better than trying to keep your food down when the boat's rolling port to starboard and there's as much water on deck as beyond it. I admit I was scared and sorry for having been rash enough to go on the river. But the truth is, I didn't expect the rains to catch us. The river's unpredictable. It makes its own seasons, its own path.
Sometimes Marquez missed being in charge. Control seemed to have been snatched from him. He was the leader of this venture upriver to understand that fateful final journey. Yet, it was an imaginary leadership. Everyone knew who was really at the wheel. The wheel was in Cordell's hands.
The bird had unsettled him. This bird that had roused him with its blood, he thought might be one of those signs that he should interpret. Part of a hidden language that he should unravel. The language that would open the doors of the river and help him to understand the boatman's fate. But this wasn't an easy task for a writer. Perhaps it was easier for a reader, somebody who can see where others can't. To acquire that skill, he had to change and run risks. Perhaps the friar had taken that step. Perhaps the boatman had. Perhaps they were all taking that step without knowing it. Perhaps the blood pumping through their hearts was already the river's blood. Without knowing it, and without wanting it, they were beginning to be part of the river's blood. Perhaps that was the price they must pay to carry off their spoils, steal their booty.
Did he die? No, he did not die. It was as if he had died. He went out of his mind and vanished into the jungle. Some say he's dead and some say he is alive. Some say he lives with the wild beasts and some say he lives with the most savage tribes of the interior. Some say he was made a slave and some say he was made a king. The writer started back when he heard this. What do you believe? At first I did not believe that he would survive in the jungle. Even if he had lost the notion of being a man and had turned into the fiercest animal of all, survival was not guaranteed. Even so, one should not underestimate the forces of evil. We should trust in the triumph of the forces of good, but it is not an easy battle. The devil takes care of his servants. Is anything else known? Indians still come sometimes with tales about seeing the human beast's footprints. I do not believe them. One never knows. Tales of the river.
That was a selection of readings from the novel Feral River, written by Brighton-based Shalista Toro and translated from the original Galician by John Rutherford. To order your copy of the book, head to smallstations.com/book/feral. That's smallstations.com/book/feral. Last time we checked in, Dave Stevens was struggling with an ever-expanding molecule. Let's catch up.
The thing seems to have a life of its own, and it seems to have broken away from the chair, and it's like a kind of large ball or something appears to have squeezed its way out of the side of the chair, and is now lying on the floor with the other half of the chair next to it. It's kind of taken on a life of its own, which is ridiculous because I can't actually work out where the hell it's come from. It's kind of like it's got itself seems to be moving around the floor now. I don't know what the hell.
That was Lost in the Fog by Sentimental Punk, and this is Yell Caravan.
This is a song that is, it's like the most positive song I know. And it says, you will see how good it will be in the next year. Wonderfully utopic. So that's my wish for everybody that's listening tonight for the next year. Bashana haba'a nishev al hamirpeset venispor tzipurim nodedot yeladim bechufsha yesachaku tofeset ben habayit leven hasadot. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבאה. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבאה. ענבים אדומים יבשילו עד הערב ויוקשו צוננים לשולחן, ורוחות רדומים יישאו אל אם הדרך עיתונים ישנים וענן. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבאה. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבאה. בשנה הבאה נפרוס כפות ידיים מול האור הניגר הלבן. ענפה לבנה תפרוס באור כנפיים והשמש תזרח בתוכן. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבאה. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבאה.
I seem to have got myself into a bit of a pickle. The things are so big now. It seems to be filling most of the room. And I actually think I need a bit of help. But the problem is, I've left my phone over on the other side of the room. And these things, it's just me so deep that I can't actually seem to reach beyond it, which is going to be rather worrying, because I have a horrible feeling unless I get out of this room very rapidly, I'm going to actually be squashed up against the wall by this horrible big ball thing that seems to grow and take a completely uniform. In fact, it's almost not a ball anymore, but it's beginning to lose itself by being squashed into every area in the room. Oh.
We're Bright Black, and sometimes we make music. We developed this show in a pub during lockdown, when everybody else was locked down and couldn't go out.
We were in a pub
on our own.
It was like 10 p.m. and we were in a pub.
We did the show in total 5 times. The maximum audience we had was 14 people. And then we had an average of about 50 people online. There's this culture online of watching other people play through video games, generally on YouTube, Twitch, or on Facebook. The audiences are massive. We do performances that happen in the real world using technology. So it's an easy transition for us to then take that online. But building on that culture of video game playthroughs, we essentially played a video game that we made that's been specifically made for you to watch us play through live on Twitch. We narrate it live and tell the story in the video game live.
The audience weren't people that play games, and they weren't necessarily people that go and see live performance or theatre. So it was like a big experiment, devoid of any like rules or parameters of a show that you might understand.
There is a version of this video game, Third Culture Kids, on Game Jolt, and there's going to be a version of it on Itch for those people who use those platforms, so you can download it and play yourself. But in this case, you watch us play it through, and essentially it's like a theatre piece that's built around two people talking to each other whilst they play a video game together. This track kind of happened by accident. It's called There's a Killer Here, but it took a while to work that out.
As we were performing it, this kind of musicality came out of it, and it was like this sort of soundscape. We were like playing live elements of that, and the game is responsive. The controllers that we use create sounds that are all in the same key, and piano notes that are stretched over the duration of the gameplay. This track kind of emerged out of it. And a lot of these kind of story-based games that are doing really well, that have like beautiful stories and characters and mysteries at the heart of them, have got like amazing soundtracks that really add this cinematic atmosphere to the whole thing.
I remember when you and I were doing Junk TV and we were showing films that were like music videos, and those music videos in the late 90s and early 2000s were like really like the avant-garde of cinema at the time, and they were far more experimental and interesting than the establishment version of indie film. And right now, I think that territory is taken up by video games that are narrative-based. They're the ones doing the most interesting stuff and pushing it out there, and also giving the audiences a role in the stories, which is really interesting. So I guess we're capitalising on that whole exciting area of storytelling.
That is an excerpt from the interactive game, story and theatre performance Third Culture Kids, created by Bright Black and streamed from a week-long residency at the Rose Hill in Brighton in October. The track is called There's a Killer Here. Let's return to Yale Caravan.
This poem is by Jacques Prévert. I thought that I might do a bit of my dance of the tongue, because a friend of mine from the UK has said that it's been a while since she's heard some foreign languages. So I thought I'd spoil you. Trois allumettes, une à une allumées dans la nuit. La première pour voir ton visage tout entier. Le second pour voir tes yeux. La dernière, pour voir ta bouche et l'obscurité tout entière, pour nous rappeler de tout cela et te serrant dans mes bras. In a few days, it's the birthday of my dad. My parents were ahead of their times and they had me very, very late, and my dad is going to be 90. And I think it's a quite a unique situation, I think, for people in my age. He's more than double my age, so it's kind of like, it just gives you a sort of perspective. It's quite amazing. And so I'd like to dedicate a little films. A film, it's great. I would actually like to dedicate a song. There is actually a documentary film that will be released in, or let's say on, the date of his birthday, and so about him and his work, so it is very exciting, and maybe it's my subconscious speaking. But the song is an Italian song, and when I was 3 years old we moved to Italy, to Florence, and I've experienced the beauty of art and architecture and nature and blue skies and olives and olive oil and olive trees and palm trees and language as well, a very sing-a-song language. So I'd like to dedicate this song to him today, and it's still in the vibe of my dance of the tongue, foreign languages zone. Partirà, la nave partirà, dove arriverà, questo non si sa, sarà come l'arca di Noè, il cane gatto io e te.
The sound of a wall cracking. I managed to get open the door. It seems to be getting so big, it's actually cracking its way out. I'm kind of trapped in the corridor at the moment. It's morbid, seem to be breaking off it at the moment, and it's beginning to just mow everything down that's in its way and ending up breaking through anything that gets in its way.
That's the sound of Dave Stevens in over his head, wrestling with an ever-expanding rogue molecule. Let's return to Tim Harbridge reflecting on a Christmas song performed live at the Bleeding Hearts Club in Brighton by Mum, Dad and the Kids.
Here we are in the festive season, a new kind of festive season where we don't see each other or dare touch each other. The mistletoe is redundant, I think, this year. I'm not really a festive kind of a guy, but I did write a Christmas song some years back for the Bleeding Hearts Club, which, if any of you know it or are lucky enough to know it and go there, it's a much missed part of Brighton at the moment. And they used to do a Christmas special, which was such good fun. You know, you'd only get to do one song, and it had to be kind of festive. And I love the challenge of writing a Christmas song that wasn't full of the old tropes and cliché that one associates with Christmas song. So I wrote a song. It was about not wanting to be in the same position next Christmas. The band I was in, I think I still am in, called Mum, Dad and the Kids. And we did this wonderful little Christmas tableau. And I'm Mum, and I dragged up, but not kind of Christmas drag, not typical Christmas drag. But at the same time, I was trying to be that put-upon Mum who is holding the whole place together and holding Christmas together and yet deeply unhappy inside. You know, so I was wearing an apron and oven gloves, and I was carrying a baking tray with a turkey in it and lots of roasted vegetables. And we performed this song. We literally had rehearsed it that afternoon, I'm sure. And it really shows, because some of the harmonies are not very sure-footed, certainly mine. And I must admit, just before we went on the stage, and I was thinking, oh my God, what are we doing? This is going to be utterly humiliating. And we really didn't have any idea how it was going to go. And it's packed out. And we started tentatively. I can really hear it. As we were going, we could hear people laughing. And so we knew we were doing something right. We just didn't know exactly what it was. We could sense it as a band, that we were doing something right and something was happening. And as we went on, we grew more confident, and the more confident we got, the more people were enjoying it. It was a great example to have a few minutes of a song, how you can transform a space. And the reception it gets at the end of the song, it just always fills me with such joy, because from that, those awkward beginnings, those awkward moments at the beginning of the song where probably the audience were going, well, I don't know what's going on. And we were thinking, oh my God, what are we doing? You know, a few minutes later, the whole energy in the room has changed. And it was such a good feeling. And I remember after the song, I just thought that was the best performance I'd ever done. And I had done a lot of performances. And even though it really was so sort of all over the place when you listen to it, it's not always about that. It's not always about the professionalism. It's not always about how bang on and tight the performance or the song is. Sometimes it's just about energy. It's about that communal sort of spirit and harnessing that. And there are moments in life when you really, really do. And they are the things that it's really worth living for. So for me, not being a Christmassy kind of a guy, I think that was the best Christmas thing that I'd ever been involved in.
Oh, you managed to get out of it. I've got no idea what's happening. It's a ridiculous kind of thing where everything seems to be happening. The building's just falling down all around. It's like some kind of... Oh, no, you're going to police. What am I going to say to the police? I mean, you're going to think, oh, I don't know. I mean, maybe if I try and explain, I can't work out what exactly it is, but it started off, it was something growing. It was like a ball, like some kind of molecule or something. It's like some kind of molecule grown inside my house and it's taking over the building and knocking the whole lot down. I've got no idea where it came from or where it's going and how this is all going to end up. It's like a ridiculous situation where I think to myself, oh, well, everything is going to go a bit wrong. Oh no, there's a policeman coming towards me now. Oh, what am I going to say? Oh, officer, oh, over here, it's my house.
You've been listening to Currently Off Air and a mixtape of sounds made by artists in lockdown, including Yael Caravan, Tim Harbridge, Silvio Mercuriali, Bright Black, Dave Stevens, Sentimental Punk, Shalista Toro, Mum, Dad and the Kids. The readers for Shalista Toro's Feral River were Becca, Eddie, Jamie, Nina, Polly, Suzanne, Tessa and Janina. And they read the translation by John Rutherford. For a full track listing, links to the artists and to listen again, head to currentlyoffair.com where you can hear all of our transmissions from 2020. I'll be back with a new transmission on the first Sunday of 2021 at 11 p.m. with repeats throughout the month. And if you get one, enjoy the Christmas break and a hearty and healthy New Year to you all. Thanks for listening.